Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Before we get started, a friendly reminder that the WAMC locked box is open now and the full fund drive begins this Monday at 6 a.m. You can pledge anytime online at WAMC.org. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Tuesday, June 4th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Siena College professor of comparative politics Vera Icarius-Kelly, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
We begin with the Fauci hearings yesterday. I thought that this is a story that made a little news and maybe not quite as much as I would have expected it to. And what I mean by that is that I quite frankly, and maybe this is a blank spot in my knowledge, but I didn't know it was coming up until it was here, that it was something I didn't know it was paramount on the schedule. But it was. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the former government scientist, both celebrated and despised for his work on COVID on Monday, forcefully denied Republican allegations that he had helped fund research that sparked the pandemic or had covered up the possibility it originated in a laboratory, calling the accusations absolutely false and simply preposterous. In an occasionally testy appearance before the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Pandemic, Dr. Fauci read aloud an email from February 2020 in which he urged a prominent scientist who was then suspicious about a lab leak to, quote, determine if his concerns are validated, and if so, very quickly report them to the FBI. It is inconceivable that anyone who reads this email could conclude that I was trying to cover up the possibility of a laboratory leak, Dr. Fauci testified. I have to say, as I was seeing portions of the hearing on television, and was watching this, I thought to myself, and maybe I'm alone on this, but I thought to myself, first of all, the guy is in his 80s. He's retired. Why don't they just leave him alone? I guess you don't get that kind of. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that they're not leaving him alone because they are trying to raise money off this. And I also think that they're trying to create a buffer for Trump because he was responsible, you know, because of the way he mishandled the COVID response. Trump and his team, including Dr. Ronny Jackson, who was in the White House at the time and who's now a congressman and should have been ashamed of himself for the things he said at that hearing yesterday. But Trump and his team mishandled the response to COVID, sending out very confusing messages. They did get the vaccine, but they didn't have a plan to get it out and into arms. The Biden administration, when they took over, they did that beautifully, very successfully. But I think that part of this was to try to begin to buffer some of the criticism that I think will come in the next couple of months as people are reminded about what really did happen in the Trump administration, and it was blame shifting. And you could tell a number of the congressmen, the way they were asking the questions, it appeared to be specifically for the purpose of creating sound bites, political sound bites. And not just one or two of them, several of them, and just retelling these conspiracy lies.
Mm-hmm. And clearly it wasn't about scientific research or evidence, because several of the Congress members identified themselves as being anti-science or not understanding how data is collected and has to be, you have to respond when you have a pandemic based on the data you have available at that time. And then with more data coming in, you adjust accordingly. And that happens worldwide. And it happened with this pandemic as well. So the entire sort of setup, as you said, Teresa, was all about sound bites, was all about sort of, you know, having us forget that it was Trump who said to inject bleach in our system or to clean out the virus or whatever crazy anti-science ideas he had in his head.
Or suggest medicines that were not appropriate for the
vermectin, sort of the horse medicine, and you know, all these crazy ideas.
Dissuade people from wearing masks.
Yes.
Dissuade people from sort of, if the viewers, if the listeners don't know or haven't seen this, I mean, the key thing that the conspiracy folks, the Trump and his conspiracy folks are saying is that Fauci's responsible for the 6 feet distance, saying 6 feet distance, and there's no scientific basis for that is their claim. They're saying that, you know, mask didn't work and he knew that, and they were masking children and elders, that he was responsible for shutting down the schools and shutting down businesses and such, and that there was no science behind that. What they're forgetting is that 5,000 or more people were dying every single day. You know, that's 9/11 plus 2,000 people every single day were dying, day after day after day.
You needed to take emergency
measures.
Yeah, I mean, that's completely appropriate. And adding to what both of you are saying, and I think you've summed it up really well, is that, you know, it was an extraordinarily stressful, unpleasant, terrible experience for our nation collectively, the world collectively. So now they want to blame somebody, and blame shifting, as you said, Teresa, is exactly what's going on here. Let's blame Fauci. And he already, because of, you know, other politicians having done this, he's been demonized. He's become a symbol of everything we don't like about the pandemic, except he gets no credit from these people for the extraordinary success in coming out of that and coming up with ways to combat that and minimize the damage. And it took a while. But the I mean, the fact is that they well, one thing, having seen some of the clips from last night and read the transcripts in the news reports today, I am very, very gratified that he came prepared. I think his answers were sharp. I think he took them on and made them look foolish. Of course, they won't include his responses in their sound bites that they use to raise their funds with, as you point out, Teresa. But that's but well, he was sharp.
But how many times prior to that have they brought him up to talk to Congress?
It was pretty common.
Yeah, I mean, it was common. Okay. And so it just seemed like a retread of that.
Oh, yeah.
And what – so – I am unaware of this, so please fill in this gap in my knowledge. What are they trying to accomplish in the sense of how do they quote unquote get him?
So the ostensibly this hearing was about something that's very important.
Yes.
Ostensibly this hearing was to look back and see what the lessons learned were and what changes that we need to make to try to improve the next time.
And prepare for
and
the
prepare.
Next time.
So very, very legitimate. And he came in voluntarily a couple months ago. I don't remember how long.
January.
Thank you.
Closed
for
door.
Closed door 14-hour interview with staff and others. And because, you know, he agrees you need to look back and see what you learned, what you didn't learn. But in the background, there are all these conspiracy theories. The key one is that he is making money from patents, and he had a grant, or somebody had through his agency had a grant with the Wuhan lab, and that this virus actually came out of the Wuhan lab, and that he tried to cover that up because they had the grant, and he totally discredited that. He totally discredited that with the receipts, with facts a couple years ago and last year and again yesterday. And this morning I'm writing in, and sorry, Joe, I was listening to you a little bit, but I also was listening to conservative radio. What were they doing? Now, I just wanted to hear, separately, I was going back and forth. But so what they're doing today is still saying these conspiracy theories and just saying he's lying, he's lying. Yeah. He came to Congress and he's lying. I mean,
with no basis of facts.
The emails.
I mean, did they ever need any facts, to be honest, for these
panels?
No,
I mean,
panels?
That's the trouble. No. It's you know, it's just being able to say the rhetorical offensive statement and not having to account for it.
And anybody who pays attention clearly has a different position. And, you know, I think we had this conversation earlier. My husband Bill and I had dinner with Fauci along with other colleagues about 10 years ago at Siena when he was a speaker at our graduation. And I must say, as you said, he's very sharp. He's very interested in having scientific conversations. And he's a great public servant because he came on a weekend, and we asked him, so why were you doing that? You're so busy anyways. And he said, you know, he loves to get out of D.C., out of big cities, to talk to regular folks about what's going on with, you know, medicine, science, and research. And we had a lovely dinner conversation, and he was a very interesting person to learn from. So
he's brilliant.
He's brilliant. We have great respect for him. And personally, I can say he's a very good human being.
Yeah. I mean, he's a great American hero.
He is a hero. I stand by that.
I mean, when, you know, beginning with AIDS and then with Ebola, the way the U.S. handled that, and then... Thankfully, he was there during the pandemic and was able to guide us through that and saved, I'm sure, thousands and thousands
and thousands
of lives.
And he was the lead researcher in HIV, and he collaborated with the George George Bush, president, on the HIV campaigns in this country, and he worked on revising and using evidence to adjust our policies, which were eventually updated to better respond.
Yeah,
and you know, saved lots of people.
And one of the things they talked about in the hearing that I found so sad, but you know, it's happening.
1 minute, but go ahead.
They asked him about the death threats. And he was saying that there's, when you have an avalanche of accusations, these false claims like this, the death threats increase tremendously. And he said, well, it's difficult for him. What is most troublesome, and he really choked up about this, is the threats to his wife, the death threats to his wife and his children.
Yep.
And that he now has to have security all the time. And you see this, the judges, you see this. In the scientists,
FBI agents,
across the board. If you do anything against the Trump, then you get these death threats. And that is just a sad situation in our country that it just is abhorrent.
We have letters. We were talking about Dr. Fauci and his testimony yesterday. Letters like this from John, Hunter Biden, Dr. Fauci, et cetera, are just another attempt by the MAGA crowd to divert the attention away from Trump. Some may think Trump is a crook, but so are all these other people. So all of that doesn't make Trump look any worse than all the others.
Interesting strategy, but possibly.
That from... John. Charles says from the New York Times yesterday, whether the pandemic started on a lab bench or in a market stall, it is undeniable that the U.S. federal funding helped to build an unprecedented coalition of SARS-like viruses at the Wuhan Institute, as well as contributing to research that enhanced them. Advocates and funders of the Institute's research, including Dr. Fauci, should cooperate with the investigation to help identify and close the loopholes that allowed such dangerous work to occur.
I recommend that you listen to the hearing. Dr. Fauci addressed that repeatedly, talking about the details of the science and what the U.S. did fund and what they didn't fund. $125,000 grant, as I recall. And he explained repeatedly how those grant funds could not have possibly been used to create this virus in the lab. And he also says he remains open-minded about what the source of the virus is, that they think they know what it is, but they're not certain yet, and he's always open to new information. But listen to the hearing, listen to the facts.
We got this from Zach, who said, Dr. Fauci should have been more combative. He's got nothing to lose. He should have cut Marjorie Taylor Greene off and said, okay, then arrest me. Go ahead. I dare you. And when she calls him a liar, say, yeah, you already said that. This is old news. Go fix the problems in your own district. This is from Zach, am kind of sick of all of us letting these nut jobs dominate everything. Let's start calling them out on their malarkey.
The problem with that is that would just denigrate. You know, he would be stepping down to do that. I think he looked much more classy, just accepting it and responding with facts and being firm. You know, but you do want to go after her for her absurdities. But it's almost worthless. You just give more ammunition and egg her on more when you do that kind of thing.
All right, next topic that to discuss on this somewhat abbreviated version of our roundtable panel. We hate go until 11 o'clock this morning. The RNC co-chair, Laura Trump, yes, she is related, attacks former Governor Larry Hogan for calling for respect for the legal process. So the co-chair of the Republican National Committee and daughter-in-law of Donald Trump slammed the former Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. Why, you ask? Well, because he urged Americans to respect the verdict in the former president's hush money trial. Hogan is running for Senate in Maryland. He represents one of the GOP's best chances at taking back control of the chamber. Still, Laura Trum, who was recently named co-chair of the party alongside Michael Wadley, said on CNN's State of the Union that Hogan doesn't deserve the respect of any Republican for his comments. On Thursday, before the jury verdict was delivered, Hogan posted on X that Americans should respect the verdict and the legal process. We must reaffirm what has made this nation great, the rule of law. Hogan said, urging the public not to pour fuel on the fire with more toxic partisanship. I would just add before we talk about this fully that Larry Hogan has been known to be a straight shooter, someone who is, I would call him a calm in many storms, and was that way throughout the Trump administration and continues that way as he looks to run for Senate in the state of Maryland. Teresa.
Well, I found this to be fascinating in that that they would go after what is probably one of their strongest candidates around the country, and someone who Senator McConnell, Mitch McConnell, worked very hard to get to run. It was quite a surprise that he agreed to run, but I think Senator McConnell thinks Larry Hogan's his best chance of the Republicans taking back control of the Senate. And if you step back for a minute and think about it, what the MAGA crowd is saying is what Trump has been saying, is that if you respect the basic functions of our democracy, which is which is a judicial system, we don't think you're a good candidate. We don't think you should get funding. That is an astounding message. Now, I know that's what they've been saying, but this attack on our judicial system is abhorrent, and the fact that they would attack their own candidate and now say that they're going to withhold money from him, while that might be, in a sense, good for Democrats because it would be helpful if the Democrats could win the seat, and if they weaken their candidate, that improves our chances, but it's bad for democracy.
Larry Hogan has been a really interesting governor, yes. I think. And
beloved.
Beloved. Very well respected. And so is his wife, Yumi Hogan, who is Korean born. And you remember when Larry Hogan and his wife, Yumi, got themselves in trouble with the Trump administration because Larry Hogan relied on his wife to get hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of masks into the United States to save lives, right? So he's deeply respected by people who revere a functioning democratic system that aids all people. He's a great public servant. And to sort of see how appalling Laura Trump's attack on him is, really, to sort of suggest that anybody who says anything critical about Trump should not be elected. I mean, to me, this is so low. It is so appalling, and it shows how profoundly divided this country is in terms of being anti-science, anti-reason, anti-democratic structure. It is quite shocking to me over and over again. I agree with you, Teresa.
To me, the day of the conviction, yeah. It was one of the most shocking things for me on the day of the conviction when I read that.
Teresa Bourgeois on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, June 4th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Wednesday, June 5th, Joe Donahue was joined for the panel discussion by former New York 19 congressperson and attorney John Faso, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and Albany Law School Professor of Law and Director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson.
This is from the New York Times. To restrict migrants, Biden leans on Trump's favorite immigration law. That's the way it is termed in the New York Times. Looking for a way to shut down the southern border in 2018, President Trump found a 73-word provision in the asylum law that he said gave him, quote, magical authorities to keep migrants out of the country. President Biden turned to that same provision on Tuesday as he took executive action to temporarily close the border to asylum seekers, suspending long-standing guarantees that anyone who steps onto U.S. soil has the right to ask for protection in America. The simple truth is there is a worldwide migrant crisis, Mr. Biden said in remarks at the White House. And if the United States doesn't secure our border, there's no limit to the number of people who may try to come here. Mr. Biden's announcement is a stunning reversal for a president and a party that spent years arguing that America was a country of immigrants. When President Barack Obama wanted to shore up his chances of re-election in 2012, he issued a sweeping executive order on immigration, one that allowed millions of immigrants to stay in the country legally. All right, Sarah, what should we make of this executive order from President Biden?
So what's standing out for me this time around, because this happens every election cycle, immigrants bear the burden of our broken political system every single time because they can't vote. So, it makes headlines. It's the top story everywhere. It's doing what it's intended to do. And it's making Biden look tough, which he desperately needs right now. And it doesn't reflect Democratic values whatsoever. It doesn't even reflect a lot of Republican values, to be honest, which are rooted in faith-based pro-immigration ideals in some cases. And brass tacks, you know, I've read a lot of people's responses to this, and there's a lot of really good points being raised about the inhumaneness of what Biden's decision is leading to. But that doesn't seem to be persuasive to voters or anybody else. And maybe I'm becoming cynical, but I'd rather raise the point that it's also an economic shot in the foot. It's really stupid to tighten the border when we have a labor shortage. What would be a better idea is to give people work authorization the moment they arrive, not make them wait 6 months, file hundreds of pages of proof that they've suffered, force people into homeless shelters, and tell them to just hang out for a while. That's a bad policy. That's what we've been doing for the last year, and it doesn't work. Give them work authorization, let them work in the formal, not the informal labor market. Our economy flourishes, our labor shortage is minimized, and families can stay together. The other weird piece is that the White House seems to be saying, well, we're not separating families, we're not tearing children out of parents' arms, we're not discriminating on the basis of religion. This isn't a Muslim ban. So we really are at the point where the Democrats on immigration are at the bottom of the barrel and finding new ways to make it deeper.
So just help me out here before we hear from the other panelists. And that is, Trump found this provision when, well, someone in the Trump administration found
Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller found the provision and then made it was an executive order.
Yes, because the executive has a lot of power in the Immigration and Nationality Act to do all kinds of stuff. And the attorney general really has even more authority than the president explicitly.
And then upon entering office, Biden reversed it.
Ish. Right.
And so this is a return to what it was, to its 2018 strength?
Ish. Not really. There were also other things that the Trump administration did. I mean, I think Stephen Miller has a lot of unresolved childhood trauma that has manifested in this obsession with discrimination against all types of immigrants, but particularly Black and Brown people. So there was a there were metering provisions, which would take a long time to explain. There were all kinds of other things. There was also, remember, the Trump administration closed the border, presumably to curb the spread of the pandemic, which was also ridiculous. So it's different, but the effects are going to be similar in that it's going to create a security risk. I'm looking forward to hearing from Bob on that. And, you know, like, when you have a worldwide migration, quote unquote, crisis, the solution isn't to seal off help. It's to figure out where people are moving, why, and either address the root causes, or in the case of climate change, if we can't do that fast enough, care for the people. They're people.
Right. Bob, what say you?
You know, Joe, I have sort of mixed feelings on this whole situation. I mean, part of me views this as sort of a cynical policy shift that comes before elections. It does, I think, fundamentally change where the Biden administration has been on immigration. So you raised some really interesting points that I would like to touch on and then hear from you and John and stuff. One, I don't think the country can afford a zero immigration policy. I mean, I think part of the concern I have is that when I look at our birth rates, when I look at what's going on with our employment rates, I keep asking sort of the question of, well, who's going to do some of the work that honestly we depend on the immigrant community to do. So the idea of actually talking about this, not just as a policy question about immigration, but also about economics, I think is really important. And it's not something that I think is being done by either party. We also, you know, so you touched on a really critical point about what's different today than was different prior to COVID. And certainly COVID changed the border position, but the whole world is going through a series of upheavals. If you think about war, if you start to think about famine, start to think about what's happening in because of climate change, because of crackdowns in regimes in places like Africa and South America, the world really is in turmoil. And the idea of saying that we're just going to, you know, close the door it sounds good on paper. In reality, it's almost impossible to do. And as I think about the enforcement of this, and I think this ties in with your comments about the security crisis, is people who are desperately trying to get into this country because it offers safety and offers a better opportunity, they're going to continue to try to come across the border, which means that now we have an even larger logistical problem of how to enforce this executive order. What do you do with all of these people? And how do you do it in a way that preserves at least some modicum of our own humanity, even at the times with these policies when we want to ignore the humanity of the immigrant community?
Well, picking up on what Bob just said and also some of what Sarah said, this is entirely political. If you look at surveys of voters, and I've been looking at these things pretty closely for the last number of months, when voters are asked what are the most important issues, it's economy and it's immigration overwhelmingly. And in many other places, it's also a subset crime. Those are the most important issues. And you'll see when voters are asked these questions, it's economy, inflation, cost of living. That's 25% to 30% when the second most important issue is immigration. And voters across the board, and this includes large majorities of Republicans, large majorities of independent voters, and about 40% or so of Democratic voters will say that this immigration is the most important issue in their mind. The Biden announcement yesterday is entirely political because he is getting swamped when the voters are asked which candidate, Biden or Trump, do you favor on specific policies. Biden is losing on all the main issues that people identify as the most important ones. On immigration, Trump is ahead of Biden by about 30 points nationally. And I suspect because it's very difficult to change public opinion on the dime. It's certainly it's kind of like an ocean liner trying to turn it around to turn direction. The Biden administration announcement yesterday, even though it's not all the it's making it out to be, it's not everything that they are trying to create the impression that he's getting tough on immigration, et cetera. And to some degree he is, but in large respect, it isn't. It's strictly a political exercise. And I don't think it's going to have the intended political benefit or effect. And as Sarah noted, it could actually wind up dividing some of the Democratic base on this issue. We've seen them extraordinarily divided on the Israel-Gaza war. And that is something that is hurting Biden tremendously. In fact, when people semi-jocularly say Biden supports the two-state solution on the Israel-Gaza war, they're talking about Minnesota and Michigan as the two states. They're worried about Senate races actually in Nevada and Michigan more than anything else. I don't see this is going to divide part of the Democratic base, which is a problem for the president, but I don't see it reversing the direction or the opinion of the country on which candidate is going to be better on dealing with this issue. I think that is kind of baked already, and I don't see this order yesterday changing it very much.
Which is horrifying, because, in some ways it's strictly political, but the effects are not. The effects are dramatic for directly impacted people at the border. And even though it's not an absolute zero migration plan, right, it's 2,500 people a day, there's the same problems about how are we going to administer that. The last time we tried to do this under Trump, there were lines of people, there were informal refugee camps that sprung up along the border of Mexico and the United States. There was an increase in crime, not among immigrants, but among human traffickers and criminals and criminal enterprises that preyed on their vulnerability that was state created. It's interesting to note that Mexico just elected its first female president,
right?
A climate scientist of all things, who probably knows a lot actually about the push-pull factors of migration, including climate change. She has a good relationship. She's been in government for a long time. She's worked with the former president, it's been reported that she was hand-selected, right? So it'll be interesting to see how she manages the impact that's inevitable. And, a lot of the times when Trump would do these things, it was political too. I don't know how else to communicate to the American public the negative impacts of these policies and the bevy of alternatives that are available. I mean, in 2018, I know John worked on a bill that I disagreed with, but it was an attempt, bipartisan attempt, right? The problem with that bill is that it would have removed lawful paths to citizenship, and we don't have enough. And that's the problem. We make it too hard. We create insurmountable barriers for people to live their life, to live the American dream to the extent that that still exists. And so, it's we do it domestically as well. It's not just on immigration. We erect insurmountable barriers to people climbing out of poverty as well.
One of the things that I think should be done, and I don't know that this could be done through executive order, but we have what are called H-2A and H-2B visas, where you can bring in folks who want to work, and you particularly see this in the agricultural sector. And it's critically important in resort and tourism. critically important. And these are all legitimate jobs, and we only let a few hundred thousand people a year come in to the country for these purposes. We should greatly expand that. The thing that is, I think, most of the public across the line politically would agree with is try to ensure more legal pathways for immigration, as opposed to right now we have a kind of stasis in the political system, which means because you do have this worldwide migration effect, and you see this in Europe, you see the political problems that it's creating for European governments as well. So this is not something that's exclusive here, but we need to create more legal pathways. The other thing politically that I would note is that among Hispanics, for instance, which you would think with, since much of this migration is Hispanic, that you would think that Trump would be losing support. He actually gained support among Hispanics in the 2020 election from 16, and all the polling suggests that he's going to do maybe even double the support he had among Hispanics in 24 than he did in 20. You look at counties in South Texas, which have changed politically and to Republicans' advantage. So it's the political dynamic is, I think, the important thing to note here. What Biden is doing is entirely political, and I just don't think it's going to have much in the way of benefit for him ultimately.
Our panel continues. John Faso, Sarah Rogerson, and Bob Griffin. Anything you'd like to say before we go to letters?
Yeah, just a couple of quick points. One, I thought John's point was really interesting about the H-1B and 2 visas. And there's another area that I want to put on the table for our listeners to think about, too, is that how important immigration has been to the expansion of our tech industry. To think about the ability to bring sort of an entrepreneurial spirit. And I would argue that at its heart, it really helped drive a lot of what happened in Silicon Valley and a lot of the innovation triangles. Sarah, you raised an interesting point that I'd like to ask you to go back to explain to folks. We've created a barrier. So people come to this country because they want a better life and they want to work. A lot of them want to work. So this idea of this, people are trying to immigrate here to take our money and take our jobs. You're talking about people who really want to work, but they are legally prohibited from working, which makes no sense. Think about a position where, okay, you can come into a country, but then you're told that there's no way for you to actually raise the money that you need in order to survive with your family. That's part of the system that was created. Isn't that correct, Sarah? Is that fair?
Yeah, you have to, in order to apply for what's called employment and an employment authorization document, or EAD, you have to have a basis, a statutory basis, which is usually predicated on achieving some form of status. So you have to go through the whole process of applying and then having immigration approve your application before or acknowledge that it's pending and that you're eligible to apply for employment authorization in order to even start the process to get the document to be able to work. So long story short, most people can't work for 6 months to a year once they get here. There's very few, I'll just say there's one way to do it, and that's to come in on parole. The folks we brought over from Afghanistan, many of them came in with parole and they were provided employment authorization. But again, that's predicated on having a particular form of status.
Sarah Rogerson on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, June 5th. We'll be back with the final segment of this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, June 7th, Joe Donahue was joined for the panel discussion by research professor and Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences and faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman. Semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and Siena College professor of economics, Aaron Pasitti.
The May jobs report is out. We're finding out that the economy is losing some momentum. Growth hasn't yet slowed to the point that it would be a concern to policymakers, but it might soon if current trends continue. What do we make of that, Aaron Pasitti?
Well, there's a lot of mixed signals happening right now, particularly with this morning's release of the employment report. So as you mentioned, there are some very early indications that economic growth is starting to slow just a little bit. You've seen slowing growth in personal incomes, saving rates, spending rates, industrial production, the Purchasing Managers Index. But these are very, very, very small changes in those variables. So I don't think it's anything to worry about. I don't think a recession is on the horizon. And I say that with particular attention paid to this morning's job report, which came in substantially stronger than what a lot of forecasters were predicting. The consensus estimate was that the economy would add 190,000 jobs in May, but they added 272,000 jobs in May, so almost a 50% increase over what was forecasted. But interestingly, the unemployment, despite the economy adding 272,000 jobs, which is up from 175,000 in May or April, the unemployment rate went up. So I think a question on a lot of people's minds is, how can an economy add jobs but have the unemployment rate go up? This is not something we see very often, but we see it around turning points or periods of volatility. So the first thing to note is that the number of jobs created comes from a survey of businesses that the Bureau of Labor Statistics does. The unemployment report comes from a survey of households. So you're asking two different groups about their employment prospects. Normally, they move in tandem with one another. So that explains part of it. The second problem is that there's still continued pandemic-related disruptions associated with sampling. Seasonal patterns have become less reliable. But on the whole, without getting into the minutiae of the different surveys and how they calculate that, it's worth pointing out that we've had over 2 years, 24 months of consecutive job growth where the unemployment rate has remained at 4% or below. This month also showed that wages for the average worker increased 4.1%, and that's greater than the 2.7% inflation rate. So we're seeing incomes outpace inflation, which is a welcome development. Job gains were broad-based. They affected all sectors of the economy. So that's the good news. But the bad news, and what you're kind of seeing with some market reactions, is that all of this points to inflation remaining more stubborn than the Federal Reserve would like. So the implication is that the Fed is going to keep interest rates higher for longer, which means borrowing costs are going to go up for households and businesses. So interest rates on your credit card, auto loan rates, mortgage rates, student loan interest rates, commercial interest rates are all going to be higher for longer. And the whole point of that is to slow economic activity, to kind of not send the economy into a recession, but slow growth rates so that inflation gets back down to the Fed's 2% target. So policy-wise, this puts Biden in a very difficult position with the upcoming election because you have consumers who are upset about inflation, but those same consumers are also upset about the cure for inflation, which is higher borrowing costs. So I know this is something we're going to talk about later, and I've got a whole separate set of notes on that. But in terms of the job report, it is a positive sign that workers are still able to access jobs. Workers have bargaining power to ask for wages that are in excess of inflation. And that's good news. And that should be a tailwind for Biden's reelection campaign, and he should be pounding his fists at every opportunity, not just the first Friday of every month, talking about, under my administration, we've added more jobs than the entirety of the Trump administration, probably even close to double that. So that can be a tailwind for Biden, and that's a good thing. But as we'll discuss later, he's also facing a lot of headwinds, particularly with inflation.
Yeah, I mean, this is a beginner's mind question, Aaron, so I hope you don't mind it. But what does this all mean for the average consumer? You know, how can they... what does it mean? Are things harder or is it easier? Or, you know, does the housing market loosen up? Are jobs harder to get?
No,
you know, do you see this when you go to the grocery store? What does all this really mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. And unfortunately, it depends, you know, which consumer and what those consumers are looking at. So let me take the, you know, mile high view. And that is for the average consumer, it has been easier to get a job. Consumers are more confident in their ability to switch jobs and get a higher wage at another job. Workers have a lot of bargaining power because the unemployment rate's low, so they're able to demand and secure wage increases, which we've seen. So that's good news. The bad news comes from the fact that since the labor market's so strong, and since we have still all of these COVID and geopolitical forces that are keeping inflation higher than we want, that consumers still feel pinched when they go to the grocery store, if they need to buy a new car and borrow money to do that, if they want to buy a new house. So in a lot of ways, the labor market is working for the average worker and consumer by giving them, solid, secure jobs with wages that outpace inflation. But at the same time, those consumers are also facing higher than normal grocery bills and higher cost of borrowing. So it's kind of a mixed bag. And in terms of policy in the election, consumers tend to focus more on the negatives, right? You take your job security as a given. You take that for granted. If you're getting a 3% wage increase or a 4% wage increase, you take that for granted. But you focus on the fact that, geez, my grocery bill's 9% higher than it was a couple years ago. And they tend to focus on that, which can certainly skew people's belief about how the economy is actually performing.
Yeah, I mean, I always wonder, and this is a question from Mathland, all these factors, are they correlations or causations? Is the job growth, does that correlate with the fact that we happen to see high grocery prices or it's impossible for my kids to buy a house? Is there some causal connections?
That's an excellent question. And with respect to housing, with respect to energy prices like gasoline and heating fuel, and with respect to groceries, that has everything to do with COVID and Putin's invasion of Ukraine upsetting oil and international grain markets. It has nothing to do with the strong labor market. The strong labor market puts some mild upward pressure on inflation, but the fact that consumers are facing higher grocery bills comes from two sources. Putin's invasion of Ukraine, and Ukraine is a major grain exporter. So the fact that Russia was destroying silos, setting fire to grain fields, and destroying the ports that sent those grains to international markets meant that the supply of grain went down, and that's a major input to a lot of processed foods. On top of that, you have enormous market concentration in the processed food industry. General Mills, Nestle, Coca-Cola, Kellogg's. There's like 9 firms that control like 90% of what we buy at the supermarket. So sure, they face higher input costs, but they also don't face competition. So they've been able to raise prices and increase their profits. So the increase in grocery prices has nothing to do with Biden policies. It has nothing to do with Trump policies, for that matter. It has to do with the pandemic, and it has to do with Putin invading Ukraine.
Oh, God, that's amazing. And apologies to Joe and everyone for hijacking the roundtable.
No, these are excellent questions.
Able to talk to an economist.
Well, let me ask the mathematician the question of how how sacred are these numbers that are reported? I mean, how true are they? What evil lurks in the hearts of fours, fives, and sixes?
Sure. When
which one of us do you want to talk?
Well,
to?
I want to talk to both of you. I'll go to Aaron first, okay. And then we'll go to and Jay. I promise you'll get to talk on the show.
I'm fine.
Okay, all right.
I'm fine. I'm actually trying to understand this. So this is good.
So all of these government data releases come from surveys, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics publishes their unemployment report the first Friday of every month, and that's based on the survey responses they get on the second week of the preceding month, but as more survey information comes in over the next month, those numbers get revised. So same thing with GDP. The Bureau of Economic Analysis makes three separate. They have their initial estimate, or they have their advanced estimate, their revised estimate, and their final estimate. So there's three revisions to the initial release of GDP numbers. And there are multiple revisions to the number of jobs created and the unemployment rate that the Bureau of Labor Statistics produced today. So the answer is, this gives us a good barometer of where the economy is, but these numbers do get revised. And again, with pandemic-era disruptions and weird fluctuating seasonal patterns that we didn't see before the pandemic, expect these numbers to be heavily revised, probably in a way that is less favorable than we would like to see.
Fran, your thoughts on the validity always of these numbers?
I only have a generic response to this, not a specific one, so I would trust Aaron. But all numbers that you read in the paper are given in context, and they're not always exactly accurate, and they don't always give you the story or the answer that they want. There are a lot of assumptions for these numbers, I would imagine. There's a lot of assumptions that are made about specific industries, about the economy, about the population, about what's a job and what's not a job, what goes into your grocery bill, things like that. And so whatever numbers you see are educated guesses by experts, of course. And but that doesn't necessarily mean they're completely accurate representations of reality, whatever that is, and we always have to look at numbers that way. We still build bridges that don't fall down. We still create roads. We can still split the atom, but all numbers are really within a context, and it's important for us to know that.
So I end up with questions too. I'm even before beginner's mind. I don't know what that would be, but here's my. My curmudgeonly comment from the sideline. Reading the Wall Street Journal, it's telling me, it's using rather subjective language that I thought the economy is losing momentum. I would say that if I was looking at all this, isn't the economy cooling down? Yep. And isn't that exactly what the Fed has been looking for? And isn't that what we've been hearing is the thing that will help us all and take us to the promised land? So if there's a sweet spot, what about today and all the cumulative stuff that we're looking at would look different to put this in a sweet spot?
Yeah. You know, pre-Trump, the Wall Street Journal's headlines and the language in their articles was fairly objective. Mm. That's the paper that I follow most closely. After Trump, you started to see these, not on their editorial page, that's separate, but in their news analysis, these, you start to see a little bit of, like you said, subjective language and this bias that's losing momentum. No, the economy's growth rate is cooling off, and that's exactly what the Fed has been trying to do. It's like landing a plane, right? You want the plane to come down at a gradual pace so you don't go like that or you just miss the runway entirely. So that headline should have said, Fed's policy objectives working to bring the economy to a soft landing. Consumers, businesses should rejoice. Mm-hmm. But that's not what it said.
So is there anything that could be better about this in terms of, I guess, the Fed's perspective as well as ours? I mean, I know I would like the cost of Oreos to come down so that I could consider them again. But but that's not happening. They're still, whatever they are, like $4.50 a bag? It's crazy.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's...
It's a great point, though,
it
Jay.
Is. No, it is.
I was in Penn Station the other day, and I picked up a bag of Milano's, Pepperidge Farm Milano cookies, $7.25. I was like, how did it become a buck a cookie?
I saw a rat at Walgreens today in the parking lot carrying a an unopened bag of Reese's peanut butter cups. And
it wasn't
quite Pizza Rat from New York, but it was pretty good for Gilderland Rat. That has nothing to do with anything. I just had a shame.
No, I thought you were going to say that the actual item was to the amount that it would be a Class B felony.
Yeah,
it was one package, but you know, it just shows. You know, I mean, somebody threw it out for God's sakes. Anyway, I don't know.
No, but you bring up a good point with the Oreos thing, and that is the people don't buy houses very often, and when they do buy houses, they usually have a fixed rate mortgage. So fluctuation in the price of housing is not affecting homeowners right now, right? It's only for prospective buyers. Cars are purchased infrequently. So, the increase in car used and new car prices and higher interest rates don't affect people except those who are buying a new car. And that's a small share of the population. But everybody buys groceries, and they buy them on a weekly basis. So that's what they see. Those are the anchor points that consumers see and base their, those are the anchor points that kind of guide consumers' perspective on the macro economy. Mm-hmm. And Biden's messaging on this has been pretty, pretty pathetic. Now, the cause of that has been entirely Putin's invasion of Ukraine, mm-hmm. because of the massive reduction in the supply of world grain, like corn and wheat and soybeans, all of these things that go into processed food like Oreos. So, sure, those corporations are facing higher input prices, so they raise prices to compensate for that. But what else has been happening is that corporations have been able to engage in, because they're so large and market concentration is growing, that fewer and fewer firms dominate more and more markets, so there's no competition. It's not like somebody's going to reintroduce the Hydrox cookie as a substitute.
I was just thinking of Hydrox.
Right? They're not going
to... The most unappealing name in a cookie.
No, that's like what that's what I expect to take when I'm sick.
This is the cookie show.
But the fact that corporations face so little competition allow them to raise prices even more than what their input price increases would dictate. And that's what Biden has been calling greedflation,
right?
That these corporations are able to, like General Mills, Nestle, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Lay's, and, Pepperidge Farms falls under one of those umbrellas. I don't know which one it is, but they've been able to increase profits, which makes shareholders and executives very happy. So the rise in grocery prices are U.S. consumers subsidizing corporate executives and wealthy shareholders by paying higher prices because they want higher profits and greater returns on their investment portfolio.
Aaron Pasitti on the Roundtable panel on Friday, June 7th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are posted online at WAMC.org, where you may also find a link to donate. To get ahead of our fund drive, the lockbox is open now. The full drive begins Monday at 6 a.m. We wouldn't be here without the generosity of our listeners and members, so please consider, if you do tune in, donating what you can. WAMC.org. This has been the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.